Regulator Ofqual has found January's GCSE English exams were graded generously, but it says the June boundaries were properly set and candidates' work properly graded. Concerned students who gained their English GCSE this summer will be given the chance to resit. Chief Regulator Glenys Stacey has just made this statement.
We can confirm that those June boundaries for those units were right, the grade outcomes were right, and indeed the right standards were maintained.
Thousands of people have been evacuated from their homes in Spain as huge wildfires burn in the hills on the Costa del Sol. Hundreds of Britons are among them. The fire began near Malaga yesterday but have spread for miles, fuelled by dry and windy conditions. Natalia O'Sullivan is in Marbella.
Everywhere is covered with ash, that's all I can say, and we're on the outskirts. We must be about 20 minutes from where the blaze started. Everyone's sort of very relaxed but sort of anticipating and waiting to find out from the police whether it's crossing over, because we've got terrible winds here today.
All tsunami warnings issued for the Philippines after an earthquake struck off the coast have now been cancelled. People living in the east of the country were earlier ordered to leave their homes after the tremor measuring 7.6. 3 million people are without power. One person's been killed. The funeral of the first man to set foot on the moon is taking place in his home state of Ohio. Neil Armstrong died last weekend, aged 82. His family are asking people to remember him by looking up at a phenomenon known as a blue moon, which is happening now. In sport, there's been controversy at the Paralympics this afternoon. Jody Cundy was effectively disqualified from his time trial event after stumbling at the start. Among the medals won in the velodrome today, Mark Colburn got gold in his individual pursuit event. And Premier League champions Manchester City have been busy on transfer deadline day. Brazil defender Maicon has arrived from Inter Milan, while Scott Sinclair has come from Swansea. That's the latest. I'm Stuart Duggan.
BCFM 93.2 is a charity and works with the diverse communities in Bristol. So please continue to support us by getting involved and spreading the word. 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 Spreading the word.
Hello Bristol and welcome to BCFM's politics show, Friday Drive Time. I'm Tony Gosling and helping us review this week's news is Lib Dem councillor for Easton, John Keeley. We were going to be joined this week by Labour councillor for Brislington East, Mike Langley, but he forgot and went to London for the week. So thanks John for stepping in at the last minute. Old Labour Oxford economist Martin Summers is here too. In the second hour after six, we have a leak this week that suggests the Royal Air Force is cancelling leave, preparing our bombers to do another Libya in Syria. And closer to home, the Tax Justice Network's coming to town, doing what they can to persuade a millionaire's cabinet to tax some of the £21 trillion in tax havens. We'll see how they're getting on. Also, US commentator Gerald Salente asks, how could the Germans allow a freak like Hitler to destroy their country? And could we be doing the same all over again now, with just a little tweaking, only this time with the Muslims as the scapegoats rather than the Jews? Plus, shocking news that the US soldiers are so disillusioned with their leaders, they're secretly going anarchist, forming their own militias and stockpiling weapons. Plus, the latest from round the world with Old Labour Oxford economist, who's back this week from his August break, Martin Summers. That's all in the second hour after six. On to our news review in a minute, but first, Bristol's two-weekend weather forecast from theweatheroutlook.com. Tonight, lows of 11 Celsius and dry. This weekend, highs up to 20. Some hazy sunshine on Saturday and Sunday, and some light showers, especially on Sunday. Well, that's the first weekend for a while that we've not had loads of showers forecast, so that's good. Saturday looks good. Sunday, just some light showers. Next week, highs of 21 Celsius, plenty of sunshine this week. That's great, isn't it? At last, we've got a bit of summer. Next weekend, 8th and 9th of September, highs of 20 Celsius, sunny spells and showers. That was Bristol's two-weekend weather forecast from theweatheroutlook.com. So, time to introduce this week's guests now, and I'm joined, first of all, by Liberal Democrat councillor for Easton, John Keeley. Hi, John, and welcome to Drive Time.
Hello there.
Now, John, you're a Liberal Democrat. It's not the most popular thing to be right now because of the coalition government. I want to know, what is it that you're actually managing to squeeze out of the Conservatives by going into coalition with them? I mean, you know, in the past, coalitions, it's given you the power, really, to whether the Conservatives are allowed to live or die, and you don't really seem to be using that. You seem to be just going along mostly with these Conservative policies.
Well, I think, you know, the pictures are probably a little bit more balanced than that, to be honest. The pupil premium has put billions of pounds into helping disadvantaged children like those in my own school here at Whitehall in Bristol, you know, where a lot of money is being made available to help support children, you know, through their education. And also the tax breaks, you know, for taking people on low incomes out of income tax altogether.
Well, just a bit. You're being a bit cheeky, aren't you, talking about education? Because before the election, the Lib Dems promised they were going to get rid of tuition fees, and then they'd secretly done a deal with David Cameron behind the scenes that actually tuition fees were going to go right up. So everyone who wanted higher education was going to have to go into debt. So I wouldn't say that education is one of your strong points.
Well, I didn't like the fact that the party made a promise and has broken it. I think that was a mistake. I think if you make a promise, particularly with a photograph and a pledge, and you've signed it, then you should stick. That should be your basic. You should stick to.
Well, particularly with the young people. Yeah, the youngsters, they are the future. And yeah, you shouldn't be selling them out.
But the fact is that the policy hasn't, up to now, hasn't been well enough sold and has actually been misrepresented. Because if you actually look, and I said to lots of people in my own ward, for the first time ever, you can go to university in this country and there are no upfront fees whatsoever. It's completely without, you know, having to pay a tuition fee.
Well, when I went to university, there were no upfront fees.
Well, but that was, you know, with greatest respect. In the last few years, there has been a charge. Labour promised, when they were elected in 1997, not to introduce tuition fees, and they went ahead, and they were the first people to introduce it. So they can't hardly sort of, like, they're not covering themselves in a huge amount of glory.
Well, we heard the last couple of weeks as well that London Metropolitan University looks like they're actually putting most of their, the beginning of this coming month, that's September, putting their services out to contract. Basically privatising an entire university for the first time in Britain, and you're party to it.
Well, at the end of the day, I mean, the point you made was about tuition fees, and the fact is that if you go to university now, if a working class child, you know, from working class background goes to a university in this country, they pay no upfront fees at all, and they only start paying their loan back when they're earning £21,000 a year or more. If they don't earn anything like that in the 30 years after the actual they've actually had their university education, it's written off. So in lots of ways, it is actually a better policy. It's a fairer policy. Unfortunately, the Liberal Democrats at that election said there'd be no tuition fees. A lot of them signed the thing to say so. A lot of Liberal Democrat MPs actually voted against the policy to put up the tuition fees. But having said that, it did go through. I think tactically it was the wrong thing to do. I said it at the time, and I still believe it today. But definitely the policy that's in place now is a lot fairer to working class people, because in the old days it was the Cleggs and the Camerons, you know, and the Milibands of this world are all going to university, all the elite, all the people have got plenty of money already, and the working class were left actually with their noses pushed up against the glass.
So do you think it's fair for the young people to be going into their working careers up to sort of 10, 20, 30,000 possibly as for a couple in debt because of the crimes of the banksters?
Well, I don't think it's really much to do with the bankers. I think at the end of the day, you know, university education is expensive. If you do get a degree and you get a job through it, then, you know, you're going to earn significantly more over your life. And you're asking people who are driving buses, working in Tesco's, to subsidise, you know, the middle classes and above. That's what was happening in the past. Now, you know, obviously this policy isn't ideal, but what it means is that if you go to university, essentially you're paying towards your education, and you have to be earning, as I said, over £21,000 a year or more to start paying the amount. It's only about £4 a week when you start doing that. So yeah, I agree it's not ideal. It'd be great to have a free education, university education system. Sadly, the country cannot afford it, thanks to the bankers and the mismanagement of the Labour Party when they were in office, the youngsters today are having to pay the price for that ineptitude.
What about Nick Clegg as a leader? Do you think he's had his time? Because I don't think personally that he's really delivered the goods as he should do and could do for a Liberal Democrat Party as distinct from the Tories.
Well, I did actually say on one of a previous BCRM programme here that Nick Clegg should stand down, and I'm actually on public record as saying.
So who do you think should replace him then?
Well, I think there's only one person who can replace him, and that's Vince Cable. If you use the analogy of a football manager, if we'd had the run of results that we've had, and the fact that we can't go out and buy new players because we've got no money, if we were fans, in the traditional sense and the board of the football club, we'd be saying we'd need a new football manager, and I think we do need a new football manager. The trouble is the public are not listening, sadly, to Nick. Once you lose that trust and the ability for people to listen to you, it makes it much more difficult to get your message across. It is tough being in government. I've got nothing against him personally. I think he's done a reasonably good job in difficult circumstances, but people are not don't seem to want to listen to him. Well, so with Cable, they are listening to Cable. When they were talking about replacing George Osborne as Chancellor of the Exchequer, because he's an absolute disaster as Chancellor of the Exchequer, who was the top person for the job? Vince Cable. The public trust Vince Cable, and the Liberal Democrats should trust him and give him the job.
But your party isn't actually democratic, John, is it? Because we've had all sorts of party conferences where proposals have been put forward by the membership. They've got vast support amongst the general population and amongst Liberal Democrat members. But due to things like gerrymandering, messing around with the system at those party conferences, things haven't been allowed properly to be debated, and so policy isn't changing. If you believe in democracy, you should be part of a democratic political party.
We are the only democratic political party in this country. I mean, the Labour Party is completely run by the unions. It's just a talking shop at their conference. The Tory Party, it's just flag waving and speeches from the podium. There's actually no serious political debate. It's only the Liberal Democrats at their conference have proper political debate. I don't know one policy that you're talking about that we haven't debated.
Privatisation of the NHS.
The privatisation hasn't gone through. I work in the NHS. The NHS has not been privatised, and there were a lot of changes made. The NHS is an organic organisation. Lots of changes are already happening. Have happened in the NHS long before the coalition came in. Labour privatised quite a lot of it themselves. They seem to have amnesia about that. They ought to go to the memory clinic.
Allowing the private sector to cherry pick parts of the NHS which are the most possible high profit making is a large, it's basically halfway there to privatisation.
Well, nobody's cherry picking anything. There's actually no evidence for that. I mean, as I said, I work at French A Hospital, I work for North Bristol NHS Trust. Nobody's cherry picking our services at all. Under Labour, what actually happened was they created treatment centres at Emerson's Green and down at Shepton Mallet, which were creaming off the top operations, the easy operations, the orthopaedic operations, and then they were paying them 10% over the top to take them, because they wanted to break up the NHS behind the scenes themselves. They created GP practice. They had an American company come in, run a load. That company's now gone out of the system, apparently, and disappeared, and has left a lot of the patients high and dry, having to find new GPs. So I'm not going to take any lectures from other parties about the NHS. Yes, there was a debate about it. Under Lansley wanted to privatise it. The Liberal Democrats have actually blocked that from happening. Whether or not they revisit in the future, I don't know. I'm surprised Lansley will survive a reshuffle, because, quite frankly, he's an embarrassment and ought to go.
Old Labour Oxford economist Martin Summers is here too. Martin, I'm sure you have plenty you wanted to say. You were nodding and sort of chomping at the bit there. But let's talk about the Eurozone, because the September the 12th has been given as the date for the German courts to meet to make a decision about whether it's legal for the Germans to go with this latest bailout scheme. We're in a kind of crazy situation where a German court is going to be deciding on the future of the entire Eurozone project. And so how have we come to that?
Well, because it's an almighty mess, and everybody is struggling to make sense of a situation which is rapidly sliding out of control. Basically, the markets have already factored in the idea that Mario Draghi will get his big bazooka to bail out the Eurozone. But the German, it's not just the Constitutional Court, there's also political problems inside the German government. The German Bundesbank opposed. And I think that what will probably happen is that this bailout will not proceed. But at that point, of course, there's then potential for a market panic, which will crash the banks in New York and in London.
Okay, so what will actually cause that then? Why would that
Well,
happen?
It's hard to say, but I mean, there's a number of different things which might be the tipping point. This court's decision might be the tipping point. It might be something that the German government says. It might be that there's a speculative raid on Spanish bonds. Anything can happen. All of the things pushing towards a crash are there. And the question of what will actually tip it is, I mean, there's various other things happening in the next couple of weeks, which, any of which could be the tipping point. But the fact is that the crash is definitely, as far as I can see, a crash is definitely on the cards.
But the picture you're painting is like the Italian job, you know, with the bus kind of teetering on the brink there. Yep. What is it that makes you think that that's the case? Because at least surely the markets are catering as much as they can for all different eventualities.
Well, yes, but I mean, the market, don't forget, has been bailed out by taxpayers across the world in Britain and elsewhere. And without that bailout, they basically wouldn't be in business at all. There would have been a crash 4 years ago. Now, what's happened is we've wasted 4 years. And, you know, that's not party political. It's happened right across the board. Everybody's wasted time. And, of course, we're now right in the end game of all of this. And I'm afraid no sense is going to be talked until we've actually had the crash. And at that point, people will recognise what an awful mess the capitalist system has been managed into. And I take the criticisms of Labour, previous Labour governments. They were far too complacent about these things. And what we've had is a kind of consensus across the parties that the city knows what it's doing, when patently it didn't.
See, what you're saying, effectively, Martin, is that the Labour Party has set us up in 2008 for this.
The problem is that Labour Party, like every party, like the Liberal Party, is a coalition of forces, and there are people like me in it who were pretty unhappy with most of the things that John was talking about privatisation in the health service when it was happening. But of course we don't necessarily get a say, and of course we don't necessarily have a democratic structure inside the Labour Party. We don't. I mean, why do we stick with it? Well, because it's like the best of a bad job. I mean, walking away is not the answer. We've got to try and reform politics in all the parties, and everybody gets sensible about what needs to be done. And I think ultimately, for example, we may be looking to a coalition with people like John in the Liberal Party to try and do the sensible things, and maybe some Conservatives who've got their heads screwed on the right way. But of course some of them are away with the fairies, as you can see.
Martin, why are people not being sensible about what needs to be done? Surely nobody wants a financial crash.
Nobody wants it, but what's been allowed to happen is that these forces have been allowed to build up. The political power of the bankers was so great that instead of being pushed into line in 2008 as they should have been, they've basically been given another free ride. I mean, for example, if you think about the fuss that went on in the Labour cabinet about not nationalising Northern Rock in case it frightened everybody with the N-word of nationalisation, and then in the end they had to do it anyway. And they should have said, well, let's make a virtue of a necessity here. And I think there's lots of common ground with social liberals like John here and myself about what the kind of things that need to be done. So, you know, maybe this is a time when the political spectrum is going to start moving.
So how on earth are the bankers we elect the government to make these big decisions as the power brokers in the country. How have the bankers managed to pull a fast one over our political representatives?
Well, if you look at the US system, it's pretty clear there, and it's also fairly clear here, who pays for the political system. Who pays for it? Where does the Conservative Party get its money from? Ah, that will be the answer then, won't it?
John.
Yeah, I mean, I couldn't disagree with anything that Martin's just said. I mean, my big worry has been, you know, I mean, I think that, you know, the revealing comment was about the 4 years. I mean, the thing I've been quite, I mean, I think the Americans are, you know, quite frustrated about this as well, is the inability of Europe to really show any leadership. And it's been quite shocking that the amount of conferences, seminars, get-togethers that they've all had, and yet, you know, we don't seem to have got beyond first base at all. I mean, you know, the Greek problem is still the Greek problem. Now they're talking about maybe them sort of dipping out of Euro altogether.
Martin, why is this? It's almost like a scratchy record, isn't it? Another crisis meeting, nothing happens. Another crisis. Well, why is this allowed to happen? I'm surely there's somebody in that room that actually wants to solve the crisis.
I know why it is, because the Germans don't want it resolved, because at the moment they've got their economies actually in surplus. They're actually hiding behind the euro. They're doing rather well out of it. And they're, you know, essentially, why would they want to resolve a situation where, you know, they are an economic powerhouse to help the others in Europe who are actually buying all their goods off them with money they're lending to them? I mean, it really is, you know, quite a shocking indictment.
government, you know, that the others have not woken up to the fact that their whole economic policy, if not careful, is going to be run, you know, from Germany. Why the Irish and the others are allowing this to happen, I've got no idea. But they really do need to wake up, and wake up soon. If they don't, because they've left it go on too long, you know, the markets are now getting to the stage where they're running out of patience with the euro. If they start picking them off, the whole thing would just collapse into a black hole.
Martin, while you were away, Berlusconi came out with this term, the Fourth Reich, in one of his newspapers, didn't he? I mean, is that... Have you got any track with that?
I think that the problems are deep and fundamental. I mean, in a way, I've got sympathy with the German position that we shouldn't be bailing the banks out again. They've been given... that's what we're talking about here. Another bailout just means that we are going to save their bacon again with German taxpayers' money on the line. And the Germans... quite rightly in one way, are saying, well, no, because there's no point. All that will happen is we'll end up with the same situation further down the line with an even bigger debt, which will collapse anyway. But what they're not willing to accept, and they have to accept, is if you follow what is actually a kind of conservative small-c policy, then you're running the risk of all the banking system collapsing. This isn't about the euro. The euro is simply the means by which the banking system is going to be brought down. And it could happen, there could be a run on the dollar, there could be a run on the pound once all this starts going. And it's not just, and you can see, particularly on the conservative side of politics, that they think this is all about Europe. And it isn't really about Europe, it's about the City of London. Because if, for example, Greece does default and all these collateralised debt obligations are activated, that will bring down things like Barclays Bank. And that's what we're talking about. And that's why Mario Draghi thinks that eventually the Germans will blink and come up with the money, because it's such the consequences of not doing so are catastrophic. But they're going to be catastrophic either way.
Okay, but the situation is that bad. The fact of the matter is a lot of these debts are spiralling way out of control, the kind of debt spiral where the interest payments are far, far more than is any possibility of ever paying. I mean, isn't there a way of a sort of structured non-payment of that debt, so that can be done in an orderly fashion?
Well, that's what we should have been doing in the last 4 years, is writing off, you know, going through the books and writing off.
But why can't we do that now?
Because it's too late. We've wasted 4 years. The political system, partly because we haven't got PR, I totally accept that, the political system is just not fit for purpose to deal with a crisis of this severity. And, you know, the Yarboo politics of Westminster doesn't lead to a sensible discussion of the options.
I think the big problem is, I mean, we're having discussions with friends about, you know, that it's some of the great inspirational leaders of the world in the past, and the big problem at the moment is that the world does not have any great visionary, you know, inspirational leaders, particularly in Europe. I mean, we are actually, you know, run by, you know, by lightweights. You know, David Cameron thinks he did a great job by vetoing things when they had that conference. It was the biggest disaster that could ever have befell this country, because, you know, this is a financial centre, and he should be going there trying, even though we're not in the euro and never will be in the euro, he should be going there to try and ensure that the European economy, you know, becomes more secure, robust, sound and all the rest of it. Instead, they just gloat. They gloat at that the Europeans, you know, the conservative right, without realising that, you know, we could have a depression, and there'll be no gloating when there's a depression, I can tell you that.
So why is your party in coalition with them and not Labour then?
Well, I think we did talk to the Labour Party, and I think if you
the
look
numbers
at...
numbers didn't add up.
No, the numbers didn't add up, but also, I mean, it wasn't the time, and the country was fed up with Labour and Gordon Brown and all the rest of it. We probably did a favour by getting rid of Gordon Brown for the Labour Party.
And Martin, what about we heard news last week that Jacob Rothschild has bet £160 million on the collapse of the euro. So is it not, you know, there's some sort of also financial incentive in the casino banking world for disaster?
Well, that's one of the problems. If you look at the hedge fund vultures and so on, they're not actually feeling the crisis. They can make money on the down, on the up, and we're basically bankrolling all of that ultimately. And what we really needed was for Obama, who was, you know, he's got the bully pulpit there. He should have been stronger in dealing with all of this, and then he would have set the tone for everybody else. But the problem is that to get elected, Obama, whatever his good intentions, he required a lot of money from Wall Street. And of course, they demand their pound of flesh, which is you can't do things that we don't like. And this is a fundamental question about democracy all over the world, is doesn't matter who you elect, the policy has already been decided.
Well, that's what we
by,
want,
by the bankers.
That's why we want funding of political parties by the
Absolutely.
State, which is something we've supported for a long time, you know, but you know, the Conservatives don't want it, and nor do Labour, because they're getting all their money from the union. So, you know, we're then in hock to
I
people
support
like
it.
Yeah, I know you do, but you know,
well, it's
yeah.
quite a lot of unions but, that don't yeah. as well.
But you,
they
you
like
said
mine?
You don't belong to a Democratic Party, so you ain't going to get anywhere.
No.
Okay, on a similar subject, into the week's news, the UN and aid agencies are lining up to criticise the Glencore boss, who claimed the world food crisis is good for business. This is Mr. Mahoney, who's accrued shares worth in the region of £500 million, said Glencore was well placed to profit from the worst drought in the US since the 1930s. In a conference call, the company's director of agricultural products said, in terms of the outlook for the balance of the year, the environment is a good one. High prices, lots of volatility, a lot of dislocation, tightness, a lot of arbitrage opportunities, the purchase and sale of an asset in order to profit from the price differences in alternative markets. So the head of one of the world's leading commodities and agriculture companies has said the current global food crisis is good for business. John?
Well, I think that's an absolutely astonishing statement to make, you know, on the misery of the backs of ordinary people around the world. And I hope that people boycott their goods and don't buy them. And I'm reminded of
but how can you boycott things like grain and bread?
Well, you could buy them from somebody else, maybe.
Well,
not
you can't,
buy them
because these people sell them to the bakeries. As you don't know, I mean, no, nothing ever in a shop has got a Glencore logo on the side of it.
Right, OK. Well, as I said, maybe the shareholders of the company need to actually look at the ethics of the business. I mean, it's the unacceptable face of capitalism, you know, writ large here, isn't it? But no, it was a very crass statement to make, a very, you know, unkind statement.
But his shareholders are very happy, aren't they?
Well, I don't know. I don't know any of his shareholders, so I can't say if they're
happy.
Well,
he's one of
it.
Them, isn't he? And he's got £500 million worth of shares. Martin, Russian President Vladimir Putin is also banning grain exports again this year.
Well, yes, I mean, the Glencore statement is, you can't imagine, it's sort of Marie Antoinette sort of statement, isn't it, really? But I mean, the real root
What do you mean by that?
Well, when
let
you said,
them eat cake.
Let them eat cake, you know. Because they said they have their bread, he said, let them eat cake. The real core of the problem here is the deregulation of commodities futures markets in the year 2000, when the Clinton administration, I think it was the Clinton administration, because they were lobbied by Wall Street, because all these markets, these futures markets, were very heavily regulated. You could only take a certain amount of money in there, and you could, and basically the idea of a futures market is just to kind of, in theory, is to get rid of all the big spikes in prices in food one way or another. Because people are hedging against it, but it was all very controlled, and therefore there was not a lot of money to be made. And the Wall Street lobbied the US government, the Democrat administration, and said, we want this change, we want to go back to the way it was before 1929. And they said, yes, okay, then. And then, of course, these vultures are able to operate because of a change in the rules. And they lobbied to change those rules because they had the power to do it. And you've got electoral politics, which is not worthless, but it certainly isn't the decisive factor in deciding what happens. What happens is decided by the wealthy and the powerful.
So
it always has been. No changes there.
The Daily Mail had a nice little box by the side, as they do sometimes, saying, what is Glencore? It was founded in 1974. Although it's listed on the London Stock Exchange, its headquarters are in Switzerland. The operations affect the global price of zinc, steel, copper, oil, and many agricultural products, including grain, oil, seeds, cotton and sugar. The firm employs about 57,000 people and turned over $145 billion last year. It has assets worth in excess of $80 billion. It plans to take over Xstrata this year, which, if successful, will make it the biggest mining buyout in history. Its $4 billion takeover of grain supplier Viterra will see it control most of Western Canada and South Australia's grain storage, as well as the majority of the world trade. This sounds like this company has got a virtual monopoly on trade. I mean, it's like, where shouldn't this sort of business be in some way better regulated, so they're not looking to make profits for their shareholders out of food shortages, John?
Well, I think, you know, food security is a very important, you know, part of, you know, everyday living. And certainly, we, you know, we shouldn't be allowing a situation where somebody can have a virtual monopoly, as I said to you earlier, and said, you know, boycott their goods and buy them elsewhere. And you said that's impossible to do.
It's actually
a really frustratingly shocking statement to have made. And I just don't really understand where we've got to in this world. You know, the whole morality, you know, of business, you know, with some people, seems just gone completely out the window. And the whole greed mentality. mentality has actually come in. And you know, we do need regulation. You know, you just can't have you know, a system that's completely unregulated, because you get greedy people and greedy companies like this exploiting, you know, ordinary people in their daily lives.
But you've been party to it as part of the coalition, John. Your party has been party to it, if I can allow to say that. You know, particularly with things like these quangos. I mean, a lot of those do the regulation for a lot of industries and businesses, things like the Care Quality Commission. Many of them have been cut.
Yeah, but this business is actually based in Switzerland and was started in 1974. I don't think the Liberal Democrats were actually even invented in 1974. So I suspect this has been going on a lot longer. I don't think everything can be put at the coalition's door, you know. Okay. And I think having the Liberal Democrats in government might actually help block some of these things, because if you look at the kinds of things we've been trying to block, you know, as a party in government, sometimes successfully and sometimes not successfully, at least, you know, we're on the side of the good guys with a lot of these kinds of things. And, you know, as Liberals, we do not like these kind of monopolies.
Martin, what about, you know, the sort of old Labour solution? What would it be to something like this, a massive multinational that's got so much control and power? It's very difficult, surely, for a little national government like Britain to do anything.
It is, but I mean, a big national government like the United States could do something, and they should have done something. I mean, that's what Obama was for, although he hasn't, of course, done what he's supposed to have done, in my view. I mean, the other company that should be mentioned in this context is Cargill, and they are a massive company, and they are they're owned by the Cargill family, so they don't have any shares. They are massive, and
the Cargill family have the shares. You can't buy
that's
them.
Right, but I mean, the thing about grain that makes it useful for a speculative commodity speculation is that it keeps. It's not like eggs that are going to go off, so you can store it and then release it onto the market at strategic moments. And
when the price goes up.
Yes, and Cargill have got the Cargill have got a stranglehold because they're supported by the US government. For example, the US government spends millions and billions making sure that the Mississippi is navigable. And that's very important for Cargill because they move all that stuff up and down the Mississippi. But they don't pay for that. The US taxpayer pays to keep the Mississippi navigable. So that's a subsidy to Cargill. And of course, it's actually a policy of the US government to subsidize their agriculture, to destroy the agriculture of developing countries. I got a quote. I did a PhD thesis, which I didn't complete, which included this quote from a senator who was a Cargill spokesperson, saying, we've got to actually destroy the agriculture of developing countries now. We must subsidise our agriculture to such an extent that we wipe out anybody else in this game. We are going to be the suppliers of the world's food. And that's actually a strategic goal of US policy.
Well, I wonder also whether Vladimir Putin's decision not to allow any Russian grain onto the world markets is also potentially, you know, anyway, looking at you know, at the crisis in the Middle East and saying, well, we don't know how this is going to go, so maybe we shouldn't be allowing out. You know, we may need to feed our own people.
Well, exactly, and of course, small countries without food security are very vulnerable in this situation. Like Bangladesh, for example, gets about half of its food from USAID, the US. You know, United States aid. So they, but of course, that sounds as if it's being the United States being generous. But of course, what they've actually done is undermined Bangladeshi agriculture, and they are now dependent on this subsidised US grain. And that means, of course, when it comes to tight votes in the UN about whether we're going to invade Syria or not, Bangladesh knows very well who controls their food supply. Now, this is the kind of geopolitical strategy that the Wall Street Pentagon complex is engaged in. And I don't blame the Liberal Democrats for this. Liberal Democrats are not to blame. They have, you know, I mean...
At last, something we're not to blame for.
No, but I mean, the point is that progressive political forces, like the Liberal Democrats or the British Labour Party or the American Democrats, are hamstrung because of the way the system works.
So
it's
becoming
increasingly apparent to people who runs the show, and it definitely ends
up... So you're saying, Martin, that until we have some sort of enormous financial crash of some kind or crisis, that we're not going to be able to break the stranglehold of the Pentagon...
Well, I mean, and the problem with that is that the collateral damage of your crash and crash doesn't necessarily lead to anything positive. And therefore, you know, you can't say, well, when the crash happens, everybody will wake up and then we'll sort the problems out. I mean, I think that's how it's going to play out. But the fear has got to be that the problems have then become insoluble and uncontrollable, and you can't do anything to save the situation. I mean, what we should have been doing, if the West had been led by people of real vision, John was talking about political leaders earlier with real vision. When the wall came down in 1989 in Berlin, that was a fantastic opportunity for the West. but we've blown it because we've bullied and we've just gone back to business as usual, bullying the world, trying to tell everybody else what to do, and we had a chance to do something better.
The one side effect that always amuses me, I have to say, when I look at, you know, large American corporations like this, and Apple and Microsoft and others, you know, which are obviously, you know, large, you know, large organizations, is how many billions of dollars that they actually have available to them, hundreds of billions of dollars, when the American state itself is in debt to trillions. And it seems to be an inverted thing, that the money seems to have moved away from the state to all these corporations who seem to be housing themselves in places like Switzerland to get around probably paying the complete, you know, it's probably a tax haven of some description.
Well, that's right, and it's not just individuals have lost money here. They've also gone into, individuals are generally going much more into debt, whilst these big multinational corporations are absolutely bloated along with the banks with fantastic amounts of money. Anyway, we're joined now by Marina Morris. Hi, Marina. What have you got for us this week?
Hello. We will talk about, do we live in an indifferent society? There are two contrasting, opposite connected worlds which press us simultaneously. The material world of prices, property, and an invisible world of our values, feelings, and emotions. The modern perception of quality of life and our human needs includes not only material wealth, but to feel happy. In hard economic times, personal financial benefits can conflict with our moral standards. The core issues of health and social problem of the developed world have a strong link with selfishness, aggression, materialistic culture, pessimism, and indifference. On one side, we fail to understand the profound effects of selfishness on life setbacks, and on the other side, we can be blind about reasons to be kind, be moral. It means having satisfaction, creativity, and fulfilling fun life. In this pressurized time, can the social norm morality play a greater role in society, or are we moving away from helping the weak and vulnerable? The Citizenship Survey of 2008-09 investigated our charitable giving and propensity to volunteer our time. The peak of 78% of people given to charity was in 2005, and afterwards has steadily fallen since to 74% by 2008-09. According to Charity Times, total UK charitable giving peaked in 2007-08 at £11.3 billion, about £188 each, and is now around £10.6 billion a year, about £166 each on average. The number of people volunteering their time at least once a month showed a similar trend, reaching a peak of 29% in 2005 and steadily falling to 25% in 2009 and 10. The statistics show a trend that we are giving less of our time and our money to charitable purposes. If the government will not help the weakest in society and we are less inclined to give us citizens, is this the kind of world in which we want to live?
Well, good question, John. What about that? Because we've heard a lot about the big society. The government isn't spending so much on community measures as it used to be. And we were told at the beginning of this government 2 years ago, it's down to the community to do it. But as we've heard from Marina there, people just have less money and less time to give.
Well, I think there's a number of issues here, really. I mean, firstly, the whole big society thing was just a PR stunt. I don't really believe, you know, that David Cameron actually knows what the big society is. Certainly, as a liberal, I don't know what it means. And, you know, my whole life has been based on, you know, sort of community politics, and that's, you know, people working together for the good. I've seen that over the years. I've been a councillor and an activist in Easton, is people come together. They don't necessarily have to spend money. This is the point I keep making to me. You don't have to spend money to give to charity. You can actually give time and knowledge and other things to charities to make them work as well.
But the point Marina's making is people have got less time to give now.
Well, I think, I mean, there is a problem, of course, that, you know, when you have a recession and people are on short-term working, other people have lost their jobs, you know, that the amount of money that's being made available will reduce. And I wonder what the lottery has done to this as well, because obviously You know, a lot of organisations relied on the national lottery for funding also, and that's declined because of the Olympics. You know, that a lot more money's gone into the Olympics, which could have gone to, you know, to community groups and other sectors of society. But I don't know if we're a less giving society. I think it's just that people are obviously, you know, finding money tight at the moment, finding, you know, volunteering a little bit more difficult because they may be under pressure at work, you know, than they were in the past. But I mean, as a society, we are a lot greedier and a lot more materialistic than we were maybe 30, 40 years ago. There's no doubt about that. And this whole model of putting a price tag on everything, which Mrs. Thatcher introduced, in my opinion, it was a disaster, really. And I mean, I look to Europe, and you know, we've been to France recently just for a very short holiday, and it's a completely different atmosphere out there. People are much more relaxed. There isn't the money there to the same extent here. People aren't driven, you know, just by this kind of, like, you know, Anglo-Saxon work ethic, if you like. So I hope we can regain, you know, that community volunteering effort, you know, once the economy picks up a little bit, maybe, as well. I hope so, anyway.
Okay, well, Maureen has been out on the streets this week asking you what you think about the depoliticisation of Britain, if I'm allowed to use that word, and the indifferent society. And before we hear from Martin Summers on this topic, let's have a hear what you had to say.
Do we live in an indifferent society?
I feel that this society encourages people to be very greedy. Not greedy, but they have to look after themselves before they think of others, and that's the way things are. It, because of money worries, nobody can spend their time to help people unless they've got their own situation covered. In many cases, people start out to cover out their own situation, and they can never get beyond that, and so they have these dreams of helping people, but they get stuck with their own problems, and so it just breeds indifference. I think we can change this situation by being what you think is the change we need, and by staying positive. We need people to have a can-do attitude, and I speak to a lot of people who say, oh no, it will never happen, and that's exactly the attitude that's not going to help it happen. So yes, we can change it.
Yeah, we do live in an indifferent society, and partially the reason to do that is media saturation kind of masking the bigger issues. So I think to be a less indifferent society, we really need to engage with, you know, national and local issues, away from this kind of pre-designed kind of media system, which is just giving us a very selective view of the country. I think to be a more engaged society, we need to experience things in a broader sense.
Most disabled people also wants to have the same right. People also don't want to be, you know, looking at people looking at them with pity or anything. They want to be just...
Oh, the Olympics game now going on, the Paralympics game, that's going to show the different size of it, and then they're going to, people's going to respect more, and I think that also bring more confidence.
I think, like, the society is based on being number one on the moment. You have to look after it for yourself. The best way is if a community starts out helping other people, everyone to band together, and from one community it would stretch to another. They'd spread a message, and once the message is spread, hopefully the whole country or the government would actually take a look and say, wow, people are actually standing up for what they believe in.
Martin, okay, what are your thoughts about what you just heard, and also this whole business of depoliticisation, the indifferent society?
Well, I mean, I agree with John that we've probably become a more materialistic and greedy society in the last 30 or 40 years.
But, so why is that then?
Well, because of the whole cult of individual success and the, you know, the lack of social solidarity. But I think hard times, one of the good things about hard times is it brings out the best in people and the worst in people. And if you think back to the Second World War, at the end of the war, quite a lot of people were a bit lost because they'd had a meaning and a purpose in their lives. The horrible as it all was, people actually felt that they were part of something bigger, part of a purpose which is more than just their own selfish needs. And I'm afraid that these kind of shocks do force, if we are going to have social shocks, and I think we are, there's two ways of responding to that. One is by, I'm all right, Jack, pull up the ladder, and there will definitely be a lot of that. And the other response is by people actually banding together collectively to do things collectively for the common good, and for that to become a kind of just what people think life should be about.
So a few more knocks on doors saying, have you got a bit of sugar and this kind of thing, if people are without.
Well, I mean, that's the sort of sepia tinted image of how things used to be. I mean, if you know people who were brought up in the 50s, it wasn't actually that marvellous. I mean, what we've got now amongst young people is a lot of critical thinking, I mean, I dislike the materialism of some of the people I see in their 20s because they've got to have everything, you know, a phone, a trainer, a lot. But on the other hand, they are more critical. And they are prepared to investigate things and think for themselves, and that has got to be a plus. And in the end, democracy only works if people get stuck in and have a go. And that's what we've really got to encourage young people to do, because in actual fact, there's not a lot down for young people in this country and elsewhere. It's looking pretty bad. In Spain, there's something like 50% unemployment of under-24s and no hope of an end in sight. Those people need to get politically active.
One of the things all those young people will need is a roof over their heads, and it's rather a shame to hear today a new law is shutting the door on squatters. This is in the Independent. Squatters will face up to 6 months in prison, and so-called squatters' rights will be scrapped as it becomes a criminal offence in England and Wales tomorrow. Ministers said the move would shut the door on squatters once and for all and help protect hard-working homeowners, but campaigners have warned that criminalising squatting in residential buildings would lead to an increase in some of the most vulnerable homeless people sleeping rough. Well, this is a first in the entire history of Britain that we've ever had squatting being a criminal offence, John.
Well, I think there's two issues here. The first issue is really, you know, in a country as wealthy as this one, why it is that there is lack of demand in the supply and demand side of housing, social housing, and it's
there's no lack of demand for social housing, is there?
Well, put it this way, Rand. I mean, there are about 17,000 people on the waiting list, and there's no properties for them in Bristol alone. There's over a million families in this country that do not have a decent roof over their head.
So effectively,
that is a failure of government policy.
So effectively, they're saying it's now a crime to be homeless and to try and actually do something about it.
Well, I don't think that's true, because I mean, if you are homeless, the Homelessness Act 1977 actually still exists, and councils actually have a legal duty to actually house you.
So how are they going to house the 15,000 people out there?
Well, those people are being housed at the moment, of course, but not in a place that they is necessarily...
Well, not necessarily. Some of them are living in squats, some of them are living in the street, some of them are sleeping on sofas, this kind of thing, under a table, for example, one person I know. So, I mean, they're not adequately housed, that's the point.
But squatting actually doesn't resolve that problem, and what actually happened, I mean, you know, I've been involved in some quite high profile squatting issues in my own ward, and essentially, you know, the people who are doing the squatting essentially are making a political statement. They tend to be anarchists. You know, when they leave the property, it's actually littered with lager cans, hundreds of lager cans. You know, toilets are ripped out, bathrooms are ripped out, you know, mantelpieces are ripped off the walls. You know, okay, the properties were empty, and maybe the landlord ought to look at that, but to go there and then have to spend £20,000 or £30,000 to put a property right. And in some cases, you know, obviously they found some cases where people have gone into hospital after having a heart attack, they come out and the house is being squatted, and in the end there's...
But they don't need to change the law to deal with that. There's perfectly adequate laws
there
to get people out straight away. Yes, there are.
You can't get rid of them straight away. It takes months and months and months. As I said, there are...
If someone is actually resident in the property, then it's very, very easy, very quickly to get squatters out. I mean, I know because I work with some squatters. The problem is that there are places which are left empty for months with nobody actually living in there. Those are the places which this new law is going to affect.
Well, as I said, if I thought there was a lot of evidence that squatting would actually resolve the housing crisis in this country, I would say it would be, you know, a weapon in the armory to use. But as I said, I don't really see it being a solution to the housing problem. A solution to the housing problem is to get more housing available that's affordable, of the right type, for people to be able to rent and buy. And that's where we've failed that, you know, our housing policy over the last 30 or 40 years has been absolutely disgraceful, and you know, the coalition came in 2 years ago and promised to start building hundreds of thousands of properties in a year. We should have done two things. Firstly, it would have given people a roof over their head, and it might have kickstart the economy a bit, and they haven't done that either, and we have got a real crisis on our hands. But as I said, you know, there is some very aggressive squatting that takes place. I've been involved with the police and with the property owners and with the squatters, and believe you me, it hasn't been that easy to get them moved out, and they've just wrecked the place.
Martin, what about your views on this? Because ultimately what's going to happen here is we're going to have even more people on the housing lists, as the squatters also have to sign up, because the police will be going in, essentially doing what the landlord in the old days used to do, which is to take them to the civil courts. It may take several weeks, but they would have to go and prove ownership of the place, and they would have to pay themselves to get squatters out of an empty property. Now the police is going to go and do that job for them.
Well, I think that's a potential disorder situation being engineered, if you like. I'm a bit dismayed to hear the sort of what John's kind of characterisation of squatters as all being anarchists and messmakers. Some are, some aren't. What the squatting is a safety valve in a situation where we've got thousands of people who are not in adequate housing. And if you close down that safety valve, I mean, I think people ought to look at the history of squatting around Europe. You'll see in Amsterdam there were massive riots when attempts were made by the police to remove squatters in the centre of Amsterdam. And it turned into a huge struggle, which went on for years and years and years. And the petrol bombs were thrown, tear gas was used, all the rest of it. Now, one of the dangers of the situation we are in is that there are plenty of flashpoints out there, like the English Defence League march that went through Bristol some weeks ago. And before long, we could have... I used to live in Brixton during the 1980s. We could have not just an economic crisis, but a social crisis. How many people died in those riots last August? Was it 5? Was it 7?
Well, what about the economics of this, though, Martin? Why is it that so many houses... We hear something like 800,000 homes in Britain are actually empty. Why are people leaving these homes empty for long periods of time?
Because they are property owners and they're entitled to keep their property empty if that's what they want to do. But, of course, then most squatting is actually in council property, which has not been used.
Or social housing.
Social housing of one sort or another. I'm not trying to give a squatter's charter, but I thought the balance that we had was pretty good. And I know squatters in Bristol. In actual fact, they make quite a point of not smashing places up because they know that it's a bad thing to do and it creates tensions with neighbours.
Well, they've got
so
to live in the place. They're not really likely all the time.
I think what we're dealing with here is a kind of demonisation of a group of people, which, you know, gets pluses in the leafy suburbs where they hardly ever see squatters anyway. I mean, most squats in Bristol are in the inner city areas like Euston. If they try and open them up in Clifton, they immediately get into trouble. And the fact is, as I say, it's a safety valve. But if you close that safety valve down, don't be surprised if you get a reaction.
There is the other side of this, which is not covered by this new law, which is commercial properties, John. And we were hearing a few weeks ago, we've got about 1.75 million square feet of empty offices here in Bristol, which is, if you were to convert that, you know, you can't really do it, but if you were, into housing, you're talking about tens of thousands of homes worth of empty office space.
Yeah, I mean, I mean, obviously, if you look at what's happened in the city centre over the last 20 or so years, you've seen a change from, you know, mainly commercial development moving away because the size and the floor space of these offices, they're not really modern, they haven't got the facilities they want, and you know, people are now moving back into the city of Bristol, which I really welcome. It's making Bristol a living city again. It was really dreadful. You go there at night and there'd be hardly anybody there, you know, apart from people socialising. Where now, because, you know, the universities have actually bought properties in there, people have, you know, developers have gone in and actually developed properties to build flats. People are now moving back into city centres, and they were commercial properties that have been, you know, that have actually been converted. And I don't have as much argument with you know, with commercial property that's remained empty for years and years and years, not being used. But I do, you know, there is an element within the squatting fraternity, I'm afraid, that have, you know, that destabilised community. I mean, the Evening Post this week has got a story about something that's went on at Stokes Croft recently. You know,
a
party. But also when the rioting was going on there, I mean, you know, it was actually kind of linked to that as well. And what I'm not saying obviously everybody who's squatting is troublemaker.
In my experience, most squatters want to keep their heads down. The other thing is here, we could be going down the US route where you get actually what is quite a... I mean, we're talking about 20,000 homeless people in Bristol and inadequate housed people, maybe sleeping on floors, on sofas, this kind of thing. If those people aren't then actually going to be able to find anywhere to live, they're going to start living in tents. This is the sort of thing that's been happening in the US all over the place, is you get these kind of tent cities building up. In fact, recently we even had somebody living, didn't we, on College Green as a sort of protest, living in their tent, someone who was homeless.
Well, I mean, obviously, you know, a count is done of the homeless people in the city, you know, every year, and it's they normally come out less than 100. I mean, they're the very, very vulnerable people.
These are people on the streets.
Yeah, these are people on the streets. Yeah, exactly. Yeah. But you're right. There is a hidden group of people, and you know, my casework, you know, is full of families who are living with relatives, or they can't all live together in one place, or they're about to be evicted because they can't afford to pay the rent. So, you know, I have a lot of housing casework.
And you know, and this is only ever going to, you're not going to resolve it by people squatting, because a lot of these people don't really want to squat because they don't want to get involved in a standoff with a landlord, or in the end with the authorities, the legal authorities or the police.
Okay,
and we must do much more to actually build more housing and give people more hope.
I'm afraid at the moment there's not a lot of that on the horizon.
Our next story,
jobless young in UK should work unpaid to earn benefits. The British government's announced that Britain's young people leaving education with no jobs are obliged to work for 3 months at charities and social enterprises in order to get their job seekers allowance, Martin.
Well, again, it's going around picking fights with people, isn't it? If I was a young person, sadly I'm not anymore, I would be very bitter about what this government is doing to my chances of a decent family life, a stable place to live, a decent job. And basically, the people at the top of the pile have got very complacent about the fact that the people at the bottom of the pile are just going to soak all this up and not going to kick back. But if they do kick back, then people will start to complain.
John, the numbers are something like 950,000 16 to 24-year-olds don't have a job. So this is a massive number of people who are going to be told, you are going to have to do this particular job, otherwise you're going to get no benefits. I mean, some of them may decide, well, I'm not going to work for nothing.
Well, I think that, you know, it is a really appalling proposal, and it sends all the wrong message about the kind of society we want. Particularly, you see very, very greedy people like bankers and others are all earning billions of pounds for ruining the British economy and seem to keep their knighthoods and all the rest of it, and they're making the ordinary working class people in this country pay for their failures. And I cannot justify a situation where a society can have a billionaire in it and somebody on a minimum wage or whatever. I just cannot internalise that, and until that injustice is in some way resolved and we get back to much more sensible figures wages wise, I'm not prepared to support these kind of draconian policies, making ordinary people pay for the mistakes of people who ought to know better, have plenty of cash and could be putting more of it into the British economy to actually get people back to work and reduce the country's deficit.
We'll be talking about their $21 trillion after the news in tax havens and attempts to get some of that taxed. Martin, we're in a situation here again, a bit like the squatting thing, really, is when people are forced out to the street, one of the obvious easy options is organised crime, isn't it?
Yeah, I mean, this is the real danger of this kind of crisis. It's not just an economic crisis, it becomes a social crisis. An obvious thing to do if you've got no money is get involved in the illegal economy, which is enormous. And of course, that then leads to violence as people settle disputes with weaponry. Incidentally, the Liberal Democrats at their conference last year voted to debate the idea of drug legalisation, because it's the Liberal Democrats is a democratic party, and that's the sort of thing that can be brought forward. And I think all of these issues are going to come to a head as the crisis intensifies. And people, I think that the Conservative part of the coalition are sadly mistaken if they think that the British people are going to put up with endless scapegoating of disabled people, homeless people, poor people who've left school with no qualifications. It's class war from the top down, isn't it? And don't complain if you get class war from the bottom up, because that's the way it works.
Well, one quite fascinating little story this week, I think we'll probably finish with this, is Liam Fox is assisting Obama's rival camp. North Somerset MP Liam Fox could have a role in the US presidential election, trying to unseat Barack Obama. Tory right-winger is reported to be advising the team behind Republican candidate Mitt Romney, John.
Well, it doesn't surprise me. I mean, Mr. Fox has got very little morals. I mean, taking his buddy around the world with him, as some kind of, trying to find business for himself, and didn't think that was wrong whatsoever. And now he has the nerve, having been caught out on that and being involved with the expense scandal as well. You think he'd go quietly, wouldn't you? But he the more he comes up, I'm sure the Tories are getting less electable with every time he opens his mouth. But the thing that really I find very concerning about all these MPs and how much time they have to be able to devote to other things is, why don't they give a refund back to the British taxpayer for their MP salary? Isn't he actually paid to represent the people of Woodspringer in Parliament? Well, why is he spending time working for Romney and writing books and doing speaking tours and running companies, which they all seem to be doing, not just in the Conservative Party but in the other parties as well? And they say, oh, it's a full-time job being an MP. Well, if it is, do it full-time or do it part-time and give us a refund or get out of it.
Okay, Martin, really briefly, Mitt Romney, who is he?
Well, he's a Conservative candidate for the Republican nomination, and he's won it. And his running mate, Ryan, is a complete Ayn Rand neoliberal lunatic. And, of course, if they look as if they're going to win, and they're going to start cutting US government expenditure on Medicare and Medicaid, then it could crash the economy.
Well, we're coming up now to the Murdoch News at 6 o'clock. Thanks very much to this week's guest, Liberal Democrat Councillor for Easton, John Keeley. After the news, it's the Tax Justice Network Roadshow comes to town. The community station for Bristol. Listen live online at bcfm.org.uk. BCFM News from the Sky News Centre.